Right Aryan Resistance calling. Right Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Steakhouse, Tavern and Steakhouse, and also our Weapons of Mass Destruction used equipment yard right here. Yeah, we're getting low on product here, man. We've been selling stuff out here like you wouldn't believe. Oh, boy. Well, let's see now. The date is the 11th, 7-11. How about that? If you play craps, man, this may be your day. 7-11-2016. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Several of you have gotten your donations in there, and I appreciate that. The rest of you, I'll be appreciating when you get yours in there, too. Let's go back to our pessimist guide to history today and get things started real good here, man. 1883, Polish circus burns as firemen fall through the ice. Some 600 people crowded into a makeshift wooden structure to see the traveling circus Feroni and Bertyshaw, Poland. On January the 13th. Then a series of accidents and blunders turned the performance into a catastrophe in which 430 died. The fire, possibly started by a carelessly discarded cigarette, began in the rear of the building. A circus worker allowed a draft to fan the small flame when he opened the door to get water to put out the fire. Next, as the fire spread out of control, a clown tried to alert the spectators, but they thought this warning was part of the comic circus act. When other circus workers appeared to confirm the warning, the audience suddenly broke into panic, and many victims were trampled to death in the mad rush to escape. Even before the fire threatened them, meanwhile, the local fire brigade was hopelessly delayed. Firemen tried to cross the frozen river on the way to the fire, but the ice broke beneath them. Bad deal. 1883, Krakatoa erupts. A volcano island between the main Indonesian islands of Java and Sumatra, Krakatoa unleashed the most violent eruption in modern times on August 26th and 7th. The volcano, inactive since 1680, first rumbled to life again in May 1883. Finally, on Sunday, August 26, Krakatoa began erupting with such force that its explosive blast shook houses 100 miles away. A dark cloud of ash 17 miles high filled the air around Krakatoa and became so thick it blocked out the sunlight. Hot stones and ash fell in an avalanche that destroyed buildings and bridges and made roads impassable up to 100 miles away. As if that were not enough, Krakatoa stirred 15 other volcanoes on Java into violent eruption that day. The sea, 60 degrees hotter than normal, was blanketed by a floating layer of pumice that eventually became 10 foot thick. Meanwhile, the air was thick with sulfurous volcanic gases. Blasts from repeated explosive eruptions charged the air with lightning bolts and whipped up destructive tornadoes and waterspouts to further impede those trying to find safety. But that was no safe place for many miles around Krakatoa. while hot ash and rocks showered down from above, the earth trembled, fissures opened, and buildings collapsed. Sometime that Sunday night, a 50-square-mile tract of coastal land sank beneath the sea, as did a chain of small islands off Java. While Krakatoa continued to be the most violent, still other volcanoes began erupting on Java and Sumatra. The island of Merak, just 3 miles from Krakatoa, sank into the sea, only to be replaced later by 14 new volcanic islands. The devastating finale to the Krakatoa orgy of destruction came the following Monday, August 27th, in 4 cataclysmic explosions at 5:30 a.m., 6:44 a.m., 10:02 a.m., and 10:52 a.m., possibly caused by the sudden mixing of the large volumes of searing hot lava and the cold seawater inside the volcano. The third and strongest of the explosions was heard over 2,900 miles away. After blasting forth huge quantities of lava and ash, Krakatoa, the great volcanic cone, apparently collapsed in on itself. Thus, fully two-thirds of the island, once 25 miles long and 17 miles wide, sank beneath the sea. So much volcanic ash and debris now filled the air that the region was plunged into total darkness for 2.5 days. The atmospheric shock wave circled the globe several times in each direction, registering clearly on the barometers as it passed, and spawned still more destructive tornadoes on Java and Sumatra. Worst of all, the upheavals created huge tidal waves, tsunamis, between 50 and about 120 feet high. Propelled outward from Krakatoa, they swept over coastal towns of Java and Sumatra, causing most of the over 36,000 deaths attributed to the Krakatoa eruption. The waves ultimately traveled for thousands of miles, reaching as far as South America and Africa's Cape Horn. Krakatoa hurled some 5 cubic miles of debris into the upper atmosphere, and traces of it remained there for over 2 years. The resulting distortion of the sunlight produced the brilliant and sometimes strange sunsets and sky glows. The sun appeared blue in South America, and for months set green in Hawaii. Brilliant red sky glows after sunset were times mistaken for distant fires. Volcanic dust blocked out the sunlight, was even blamed for a 1 degree Fahrenheit drop in the average temperatures throughout the northern hemisphere during the 19th century. To say this blast changed the face of Indonesia would be an understatement. Well, there you go, boys and girls. Reading to you from the Pessimist's Guide to History. Now, you got to understand, this type of thing can happen any time. Absolutely any time. There are thousands of volcanoes on land, and there's thousands of volcanoes under the sea. And you got to understand that at any time, one or more of them could go bananas and your day would be ruined. So just remember that. Mother Nature pulls that kind of stuff every once in a while. You've heard of that outfit called AIPAC, the Super Jew outfit, the one that tells all the senators and congressmen what to do and what they want, and it's all going to be for Israel. Well, I think they might have a little problem. I've dug up some information here for you, and I've converted it to Cynthia, who's going to read it for you. So if it gets too boring, we'll cut it off, but I think it's something you should hear. Yes, I do. Hold on.
Any attempt to launch a pro-Israel lobbying group whose voice differs and at critical junctures disagrees with AIPAC's must do more than raise money, develop political contacts, and lobby. It must confront an entrenched Jewish leadership that has convinced large parts of the community to equate AIPAC's interests with those of Israel. In one particularly ham-handed attempt that would make any monopolist proud, AIPAC attacked the Zionist Organization of America, ZOA, and its long-standing president Morton Klein for attending a critical committee meeting on the Hill and allegedly acting in an amateurish and hostile fashion. Steve Grossman, then AIPAC's president, complained, "This has to stop before it goes further and significant damage is really done." Howard Koehr, then AIPAC's managing director and for the past 20 years its executive director, wrote to the Conference of Presidents, "Disciplinary action must be taken against ZOA to ensure such behavior is not repeated." Monopolists are also notoriously averse to innovation and the risks that it entails. In its place, they burnish a core product offering and invest heavily in convincing the public that they are responsible stewards of the market they monopolize. AIPAC's annual policy conference, termed a Jewish Super Bowl, or Zionist Hootenanny, functions as such an opiate. Attendees at this confab represent a broad cross-section of American Jewry, and speakers often include the United States presidents and Israeli prime ministers. At the end of the day, though, the policy conference remains a feel-good event that galvanizes grassroots activists and rewards attendees, not a substantive accomplishment. As the 2016 policy conference demonstrated, politicians more than eager to spout pro-Israel platitudes to the applause of AIPAC's members still follow the party line when it comes to legislation. The overwhelming majority of AIPAC's Democratic congressional friends supported the Obama/Iran deal. AIPAC's core substantive product offering is the annual, currently roughly, $3 billion in military aid that the United States provides to Israel. Because parts of this aid require annual renewal, there is always a reason to lobby Congress on an issue on which the vast majority of Congress people are eager to oblige. The AIPAC briefing book highlights the importance of foreign aid to its offerings. AIPAC urges all members of Congress to support Israel through foreign aid, government partnerships, joint anti-terrorism efforts, and the promotion of peace through a negotiated two-state solution, a Jewish state of Israel living alongside a demilitarized Palestinian state. Yet though the foreign aid bill is undoubtedly important, it may be more important to AIPAC than it is to Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, addressing a joint session of Congress in 1996, suggested that it was time for Israel to begin to reduce its reliance on the United States aid, an idea boasting continued support from some of Israel's strongest backers. According to retired Ambassador Yoram Ettinger, then Minister for Congressional Affairs at the Israeli Embassy, irate AIPAC leaders accosted Netanyahu outside the capital after his speech to berate him, saying, "Israel can't forego foreign aid, it's our flagship issue." It is thus unsurprising that AIPAC, in the words of one observer, has shown no signs of ending its efforts to push Congress to pass the annual military aid bill. Whatever significance military aid may have to Israel, it is central to AIPAC's self-image, reputation, and standing in the community. By eschewing policy innovation while occupying the entire field, AIPAC has imposed upon pro-Israel activism the same sclerosis that monopolists commonly impose upon the markets they dominate. In Israel's case, that sclerosis is both misplaced and dangerous. Israel is a small state surrounded by enemies seeking her destruction and the genocide of her citizens. As a foreign government dependent on the United States, Israeli diplomacy compels conciliatory statements about American policy and leadership. American activists are under no compulsion to believe such statements. To the contrary, American supporters add maximum value when championing the tough truths that diplomacy puts beyond Israel's reach. Yet rather than pushing to expand Israel's political playing field, AIPAC has instead filtered Israel's necessary diplomatic risk aversion through the partisan and policy preferences of its own membership. To pick but one example, numerous American Jewish leaders, including prominent members of the Conference of Presidents, have recognized that American energy independence would weaken OPEC's hold over American policy and thus serve Israel's interests. Rather than taking a leadership role on the issue, however, AIPAC demurred, explaining, "We knew as American Jews we couldn't touch environmental issues and have any credibility with our community. American Jews don't want to destroy Alaska to import a few barrels less from Angola. A political monopolist who avoids alliances for reasons unrelated to its mission necessarily weakens that mission in AIPAC's case, lobbying in Israel's best interests." In classic monopolist form, AIPAC protects its market by playing to avoid losing rather than to win. A pro-Israel lobby that played to win would articulate basic, immutable principles for which it would fight, and it would count among its friends only those elected officials who supported these positions even when politically inconvenient. Such a lobby would pressure Israel's neighbors to work with Israel while removing pressure on Israel to take risks that compromise its security, and it would stop pushing to reward Arab incitement and terror with a PLO-led state. Above all, a pro-Israel lobby playing to win would innovate on policy, promoting truths and ideas that run counter to conventional wisdom, even if such innovations remain minority positions for the years that lobbyists often need to assemble winning coalitions. Anti-Israel forces understand the strategic imperative of policy innovation, and they are rarely bashful about pushing ideas whose absurdity is apparent to all people of good faith. Yasser Arafat first fabricated temple denial from whole cloth in 2000, but within the past year the New York Times has detailed the controversy surrounding Jewish claims to the Temple Mount, and UNESCO has declared the Kotel a Muslim holy site. BDS, which grew out of the United Nations' rapidly anti-Semitic Durban Conference in 2001, began in earnest with a coalition of radical fringe NGOs in 2005. By 2015, allegations of Israeli apartheid and genocide had come to dominate discourse among American academics and European parliamentarians. Or consider the course of the so-called two-state solution, once a policy innovation of the far left but now conventional wisdom. In 1980, Jimmy Carter, hardly an Israel advocate, opposed as destabilizing the emergence of an Arab state wedged into disputed territories that Israel had liberated in 1967. Yitzhak Rabin, martyred in 1995 for his dovish politics, never wavered from his opposition to a Palestinian state. In 1998, 5 years into the Oslo process, Hillary Clinton publicly implied support for an independent Palestine. Her husband's White House issued an official repudiation. Yet AIPAC now doggedly promotes a negotiated two-state solution, a Jewish state of Israel living alongside a demilitarized Palestinian state. The erosion of Israel's reputation and diplomatic standing among Western governments, and in particular, among Western parties to the left of center, should provide fertile ground for policy innovation. Who objects to the canard that Israel is an occupier? Who lobbies the White House to recognize an undivided Jerusalem within its full current municipal boundaries as Israel's capital? Who takes to task every politician who differentiates the anti-Israel terror of Hamas, Fatah, and Hezbollah from the world's other instances of Islamist terror? Who challenges the calls for balance in confronting the terrorist mini-state of Gaza that are oddly absent from any discussion of other terrorist safe havens? Who emphasizes the connection between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism? Who pushes American politicians to revisit the Oslo Agreement, particularly following Mahmoud Abbas's unilateral withdrawal from its terms during his 2015 speech to the UN General Assembly? To each of these questions, the answer is not AIPAC. In typical monopolist fashion, AIPAC does more than underinvest in policy innovation. It objects to policy innovations that might imperil its monopoly. That objection traps pro-Israel activism behind a lowest common denominator bipartisan strategy in an increasingly partisan world. In a competitive environment, fundamental market shifts create openings for small players pursuing prescient strategies to grow, while bigger players pursuing reactive strategies suffer. Monopolists rarely see the signals of a market shift that competition would provide. Instead, they pursue tried and true strategies until a crisis lays bare the mismatch between those strategies and the new market dynamics. For decades, AIPAC has prided itself on its bipartisanship, avoided explicit public statements of partisan preference, and forged coalitions that cut across party lines. The mere viability of such a strategy, however, hinges upon the existence of sizable pro-Israel factions in both parties and the willingness of those factions to stand together against anti-Israel voices emanating from their own sides of the aisle. The rise of J Street almost a decade ago, and the overwhelming Democratic support for Obama's Iran deal last summer, should have signaled a shift in the market that AIPAC monopolizes. In typical monopolist fashion, however, AIPAC has given no indication of reconsidering the propriety of its strategy in today's political terrain. Throughout the late 20th century, the political parties took clear and divergent stands on economic and cultural issues while demanding far less fidelity to a foreign policy agenda. Hawks and doves, isolationists and internationalists, pragmatists and realists, all coexisted in sizable numbers within both parties. The overwhelming majority of American Jews followed their economic and social preferences into the Democratic Party, where they found a faction that supported their pro-Israel views. Foreign policy alliances, on issues far broader than Israel, grew across party lines in a manner that served the country well. By allowing proponents of all foreign policy perspectives and approaches in either party, every president found bipartisan support. Politicians at odds over economics or culture found common ground on foreign policy. The nation provided a reasonably unified image to those observing from abroad, Israel served as a unifying feature in American Jewish life. An AIPAC rode pro-Israel bipartisanship to a position of pride among American activist groups. Unfortunately, the parties redefined themselves for the post-9/11 world and its consequent focus on foreign policy. During the 2002 debate about ending Saddam's rule, sizable numbers of congressional Democrats gave President George W. Bush grudging support, hedged with statements meant to reassure their supporters that they did not really trust him. Those supporters were hardly reassured. The progressive Netruts sought to push those deemed insufficiently critical of Bush's unilateral belligerence to the periphery of the party, where they could either recant or depart. By late 2003, these progressives had become a powerful force in the Democratic Party, catapulting the emphatically anti-war Howard Dean into front-runner status before caving to the establishment favorite, John Kerry, who responded to the new tenor of his party by running as both hawk and dove, a candidate who had famously voted for the war before he voted against it. When that doublespeak failed, the Netruts seized control of the DNC for Dean in January 2005. By mid-2006, when the Democrats determined that Joe Lieberman, the party's vice presidential nominee only 6 years earlier, was too hawkish for their party, the progressive takeover was complete. For the first time in decades, the notoriously fractious Democrats had cohered behind a progressive worldview. The world was suffering from misguided and oppressive American imperial overreach. Reduced military engagement would make America seem less belligerent, and consequently less likely to invite attack. Reduced commercial and cultural engagement would make America appear less domineering, and consequently less likely to invite animosity. Increased reliance on multinational organizations would improve American prospects for diplomatic success. And the reinvestment of savings from these retrenchments would build a superior social welfare system. Meanwhile, the overwhelming majority of Republicans moved in the opposite direction. In the conservative worldview, American exceptionalism is real, hard-won, and critical to global stability. The Pax Americana that had begun at the end of World War II and grown following the collapse of the Soviet Union was a noble and elevated experiment. The global order that spread political rights, personal dignity, improved health and nutrition, and material prosperity around the planet was a consequence of America's leadership. The violent dysfunctionality of the Arab/Islamic world, and the emanations of that violence, posed significant threats to that order. Unsurprisingly, those taking these divergent worldviews also see Israel very differently. To a progressive, even one with no inherent animus toward Jews, Israel mirrors the worst of America, an oppressor state occupying the territory of an indigenous people, practicing apartheid policies, demonstrating contempt for the international community, and seeking to play by a unique set of rules. To a conservative, the situation is just as clear. Israel possesses all of the right cultural norms and values, stands allied against America's enemies, and places itself on the front lines of a civilizational battle. Israel holds itself to exceptional standards of humanity and decency despite the constant threats to its existence and widespread opprobrium. Support for Israel is thus a logical and consistent part of the conservative worldview, while an outlier among progressives. The elections of 2006 through 2010 solidified the resorting of the parties by worldview, and furthered their divergent views of Israel. Hillary Clinton's hawkish Senate record cost her the 2008 Democratic nomination. Foreign policy realists boasting impeccable Republican pedigrees from James Baker and Brent Scowcroft to Colin Powell and Chuck Hagel suddenly found warmer receptions on the left than on the right. Tony Blair, leader of the maturing European left in the 1990s, discovered that Republicans were his most receptive American audience. In 2016, Senator Bernie Sanders galvanized young Democrats behind positions overtly hostile to Israel. Sanders was also the only presidential candidate who skipped AIPAC's 2016 policy conference. His submitted comments parroted much of the standard progressive anti-Israel rhetoric and earned widespread praise from the left, including J Street. AIPAC's strategic bipartisanship inevitably dismays both those who view Israel through the progressive lens and those who view it through the conservative lens. In the face of the post-9/11 transformation of the American foreign policy debate, AIPAC remains rigidly dedicated to blind bipartisanship, doing little to educate or inform its members that most of them are trapped in an increasingly progressive Democratic Party boasting an increasingly powerful anti-Israel caucus. Polls show a partisan split on the issue of Israel v. Palestinians of 83-48, with pro-Israel Democrats now representing a minority of their party. That 35% gap makes Israel one of the most extreme partisan issues in the current political climate, not remotely a matter of bipartisan consensus. J Street studied its market well before launching. Its founders understood that AIPAC could not help but alienate the large numbers of Jewish Americans who consider themselves progressives but harbor some affinity for Israel. The rival organization built upon AIPAC's unyielding dogma that there is no difference between the parties to insist that the anti-Israel policies gaining salience among Democrats represent the true pro-Israel positions. By redefining Zionism as something close to its opposite, J Street gives American Jews a license to remain proudly progressive and frees Democrats to be increasingly adverse while still maintaining they are pro-Israel. To J Street's supporters, Israel's true interests at any given point in time are precisely those that the left says they are, thereby eliminating any potential dilemmas arising from a divergence of Israel's interests from those of the Democratic Party's progressive wing. Furthermore, by providing consistent visible Jewish support for President Obama's foreign policy agenda, J Street has already conferred value upon both its members and the Democratic politicians who need their support. The Obama policy agenda that enabled J Street's rise caught AIPAC sleeping. For the first 6+ Obama years, nearly every policy or pronouncement touching upon Israel produced a predictable sequence. J Street emerged as an early, enthusiastic supporter, lauding the president's boldness and urging him to move in an even more progressive direction. AIPAC noted both positives and negatives in the president's moves, studied their implications from all angles, and eventually announced cautious, grudging support. As late as December 2013, amid widespread alarm triggered at the Obama administration's dealings with Iran. AIPAC called a special meeting of the Conference of Presidents to demand that Jewish groups stop criticizing the president. AIPAC Executive Director Howard Koer declared at that meeting that AIPAC and Obama share the same goals and have only a difference of strategy, an assertion that AIPAC ought now regret. Finally, in Year 7, Israel's government took an unprecedented step to preempt AIPAC. In 2014, AIPAC had been willing to support the president's call to end sanctions on Iran as a step toward easing negotiations. When it came to assessing the package that the Obama team negotiated in 2015, however, Israel's prime minister delivered a bold and controversial speech to Congress that forced AIPAC's hand. AIPAC had little choice but to agree publicly with the Israeli consensus that the deal represented an existential threat. For the first time in many years, AIPAC appeared to launch a full-throated campaign to defeat a Democratic administration priority, though it simultaneously offered counterproductive, if not overtly cynical, reassurances that it would exact no price from friends who supported the deal. In 2016, AIPAC continues to monopolize the field of activists eager to provide policy support for Israel, while J Street provides a useful outlet for those unwilling to abandon progressive policy priorities while maintaining or manipulating a pro-Israel self-image. Another clearly visible market niche, however, remains unfilled. Activists adopting the conservative worldview unsatisfied with the compromises inherent in bipartisan policy formulations. The arrival of a partisan pro-Israel group to AIPAC's right will dethrone the Israel monopolist but not destroy it. AIPAC has invested decades in developing a powerful brand, exceptional connections, a demonstrated ability to work across the aisle, and unrivaled lists of donors and grassroots supporters. Furthermore, AIPAC's flagship product, the foreign aid bill, is likely to become increasingly important as fallout from the Iran deal triggers a regional arms race. Whether broadly appropriate or not, to the degree that AIPAC can retain its bipartisan relationships, it can help ensure continued military aid to Israel regardless of the configuration of power in Washington. In addition, though few cast it in such terms, AIPAC plays two other critical roles. It serves as a Jewish pride organization and as a safe space for Truman Democrats. Its annual policy conference provides Jewish pro-Israel activists with a brief respite from pervasive anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. An AIPAC's membership may represent the largest remaining group of hawkish Democrats voters who reject progressive foreign policy even as they support other parts of the progressive agenda. By providing a forum for such voters, AIPAC fills a niche critical to American national security as well as to the state of Israel. Voters who place primacy on the ascendance of progressive cultural mores and slash or economic distribution, while still favoring a strong national defense, deserve a forum in which they can speak comfortably. AIPAC appears to be the only prominent organization filling that need. Without such a forum, Democratic approaches to this traditionally bipartisan belief will range from cavalier to disdainful, much to the detriment of national security. The pro-Israel community should push AIPAC to reposition itself with a clear eye on contemporary reality. AIPAC can best serve the pro-Israel cause by redeploying its formidable assets to help pro-Israel, national security-conscious Democrats defeat the anti-Israel progressives ascendant in their party. Certainly the most effective way to ensure continued bipartisan support for Israel. New organizations promoting policy innovation and adaptive political strategies must also enter the pro-Israel market. However, to address challenges, push policies, and forge alliances on behalf of Israel that run counter to AIPAC's strategic approach and the preferences of its members. AIPAC's directors and customers, i.e., the Jewish community's leading philanthropists and the grassroots activists who genuinely want to protect Israel and the U.S.-Israel relationship, should accept nothing less.
Well, that was a long one, but it was a very revealing one if you read between the lines that there's a crack in the pro-Israel operations. And AIPAC has got some competitors and so forth. And I think that that the progressives who are giving AIPAC a hard time and Israel a hard time on the Palestinian issue are probably going to grow stronger and stronger. It's going to be interesting because this all plays to a good audience, as far as I'm concerned, that will weaken the support of Israel. And so, that in fact, that paper was written by pro-Israel people. It was not written by our supporters or anybody like that. So, read it and read it again until you understand it. Read between the lines. The Jews don't know quite what to do with Trump. Listen to this. On the night of March 21st in a packed convention center in Washington, D.C., thousands of members of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee rose in raucous applause for Donald Trump. While Trump was the front-runner for the Republican nomination and as such a seemingly logical person to address AIPAC, he was also a candidate who had endorsed the use of torture, proposed the deportation of 11 million undocumented immigrants, characterized Mexican immigrants as rapists, declared that he would build a wall along the southern border and make Mexico pay for it, proposed a ban on admitting Muslims into the country. Let's see here. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Come on, computer, quit screwing around. But the painful, indeed tragic reality is not only that Trump, the logical outcome of a 60-year trend in Republican politics to play on racial and ethnic hatred, but as such he's even more specifically the predictable results of decades-long effort by political conservatives, both Jewish and Gentile, to flip the Jewish vote, or at least significant portion of it, from Democrat to Republican. How about that? When you're asked to check many of your cherished beliefs at the political door, meaning support for church-state separation, for racial and gender equality, for gay and lesbian rights, for immigration reform, for the legitimate role of labor unions in the workplace, for governmental role in providing social safety net, and when you're asked to exchange them all for a very skewed, particularly definition of supporting Israel and Zionism, then you shouldn't be surprised that what you get is Trump. Had Trump not captured the nomination, it would have gone to Ted Cruz, who espoused many of the very same positions and looked less extreme only in comparison to reckless inciting Trump. Anyhow, I'm having trouble scaling this article down, but what it's really saying is that the Jews are more interested in allegedly the survival of Israel than they are a lot of other liberal issues. So the Republicans are trying to flip more and more Jews away from the Democrats into the Republican Party. Well, there's one thing I support Obama on, and that is that they're determined to use its final 6 months in office to take a series of executive actions to advance the nuclear agenda the president has advocated since his college days. As part of Obama's late push to polish a foreign policy legacy that is plagued by challenges on several other fronts. President Obama announced his drive to reduce the role of nuclear weapons and eventually rid the world of them in his first major policy or foreign policy speech in Prague in 2009. In his first years, he achieved some successes, such as the New START Treaty with Russia, and so on and so on. Now, if he pushes too hard, the military-industrial complex will kill him. They can't stand anybody going against their proliferation of nuclear weapons all over the world. And, of course, if Trump gets in, and if he's anything like he sounds, he's going to be pushing it even more nuclear weapons. And that's a bad, bad situation. Well, as a matter of historical fact, it may be correct, as the Post reported Sunday, the Whitewater prosecutors, remember that, now say they came close to filing charges against then First Lady Hillary Clinton back in the 1990s. As a result of legal and factual analysis from one who observed this investigation at every step, never a close call at all. Let's see here. Putting aside significant ethical questions about the propriety of prosecutors casually reminiscing decades later about the potential guilt of subjects who were never charged, the facts speak for themselves. While independent counsel Kenneth W. Starr and his staff may have secretly hoped for and ruminated about the possibility of bringing a criminal case against Clinton, they never even presented an indictment to the many grand juries they used. This was not for want of trying. The independent counsel investigation lasted 8 years. Generated more than 3,000 grand jury subpoenas, collected more than 10 million pages of documents, and cost more than $70 million, adjusted for inflation, which dwarfed all other independent counsel investigations, including Iran-Contra, and exceeded the cost to the government of failure of the savings and loan ostensibly under investigation. Clinton testified fully and truthfully under oath 6 times. If she had, in fact, given false testimony, there was an ample opportunity for prosecution. Largely forgotten today is the origin of the Starr investigation, which was a failed $203,000 Arkansas land deal. Well, I'm not going to go ahead and read all that. You can get that on the Internet, all that crookedness and so forth. But they've had several times they could have had those two jerks, the Clintons, and they let them slip through their fingers. Which means to me, the Clintons have a hell of a lot of stuff on people. They've got the power, and now they got the money, but they've got a hell of a lot of incriminating information that people in Washington don't want them to give out. Well, the Black KKK is working strongly in Chicago. I forget to report on them from once in a while. A man was fatally shot on a basketball court in Inglewood, and 15 other people were wounded in shootings between Saturday morning and Sunday morning, police said. About 10:45 p.m. Saturday, a 15-year-old boy and his 21-year-old and a 21-year-old man were shot while playing basketball at Ogden Park. They told investigators they heard shots and felt pain. The boy was shot in the arm and got himself to the Holy Cross Hospital. Wait a minute here. Well, I'll tell you, these news things. Well, anyhow, that's it. Some of these news things jump around like you can't believe. But anyhow, two dead and 15 wounded. That's a pretty peaceful weekend, actually, for the Black KKK. We got to salute our Black KKK supporters.
Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Mr. Mayor, I want to ask you about something former Speaker Newt Gingrich said, which is that he said white Americans can't understand the extra risk that comes with being black in America, and that whites instinctively underestimate the danger of the black experience. What do you think about that?
I agree with that completely. I agree largely with the sentiments of Congressman Elijah Cummings. The reality is we have to look differently at race in America if we're going to change this. We've been looking at it the same way for 20 years, and here's where we are. And we both have to try to understand each other. First, let me say my deep sympathy for the people of Minnesota, people of Louisiana, people of Texas, and of Dallas. And I'd like them all to remember that although these incidents happen in different ways, they all share it together as Americans. We share this violence together as Americans. So maybe whites have to look at it differently, and blacks have to look at it differently. Whites have to realize that African-American men have a fear, and boys have a fear of being confronted by the police because of some of these incidents. Some people may consider it rational. Some people may consider it irrational, but it's a reality. It exists. And there's a second reality in the black community. The second reality in the black community is there's too much violence in the black community. So a black will die 1% or less at the hands of the police, and 99% at the hands of a civilian, most often another black. So if you want to protect black lives, then you got to protect black lives not just against police, which happens rarely, although with tremendous attention, and which happens every 14 hours in Chicago. Every 14 hours, and we never hear from Black Lives Matter. Well, so, if you want to deal with this, on the black side, you've got to teach your children to be respectful to the police, and you've got to teach your children that the real danger to them is not the police. The real danger to them, 99 out of 100 times, 9,900 out of 1,000 times, are other black kids who are going to kill them. That's the way they're going to die.
So, Mr. Mayor,
now on the white side, we have to understand that whether we get it or not, there is this extraordinary fear of the police, and police have to institute a policy of zero tolerance, like we did for crime in New York. Zero tolerance, no disrespect. Way back 14 years ago, Commissioner Howard Safer began a program in New York City called Courtesy, Professionalism, and Respect. It was continued by the next three police commissioners, including the one you just had on now.
Mr. Mayor, let me just ask you. You started off by saying that white Americans have to understand that this is happening in the black community, and then at the end you said members of the black community have to teach their children to behave in front of the police. That those messages seem to conflict with one another.
Of course they don't. If I were a black father and I was concerned about the safety of my child, really concerned about it, and not in a politically activist sense, I would say be very respectful of the police. Most of them are good. Some can be very bad. And just be very careful.
And so what a police...
I'd also say be very careful of those kids in the neighborhood and don't get involved with them because, son, there's a 99% chance they're going to kill you, not the police. And we got to hear that from the black community. And what we got to hear from the black community is how and what they are doing among themselves about the crime problem in the black community. When there are 60 shootings in Chicago over the 4th of July and 14 murders, and Black Lives Matter is non-existent, and then there's one police murder of very questionable circumstances, and we hear from Black Lives Matter, we wonder, do Black Lives Matter or only the very few black lives that are killed by white policemen? But not all those black lives that are killed by other blacks. And on the black side, what they hear from us is constantly defending the police. Now, I'll give you an example. I had a police officer who brutally attacked a gentleman named Amadou Diallo. That police officer is now sitting in jail for 25 years due to the work of my police commissioner, Howard Safer, and the prosecution of now Attorney General Loretta Lynch. I also had police officers who were wrongly accused and acquitted by a jury, even though mobs were calling for them to be put in jail, despite the fact that a jury found them not guilty. So these are complicated situations, and we have to try to understand each other.
Right. Just a final question, sir. You said that the Black Lives Matter movement has put a target on the back of police officers. When members of the African-American community see videos as they have this week, they feel like there is a target on young black men. Explain your response about how they put a target on police officers, how that can match up when people see these videos.
Well, when they talk about killing police officers.
But they don't.
When they sing, they sure do. They sing rap songs about killing police officers, and they talk about killing police officers, and they yell it out at their rallies, and the police officers.
Mr. Mayor, please
let me finish. And when you say Black Lives Matter, that's inherently racist.
Well, I think there are
Black Lives Matter, White Lives Matter, Asian Lives Matter, Hispanic Lives Matter. That's anti-American and it's racist. Well, of course, Black Lives Matter, and they matter greatly. But when you focus in on 1% of less than 1% of the murder that's going on in America, and you make it a national thing, and all of you in the media make it much bigger than the black kid who's getting killed in Chicago every 14 hours, you create a disproportion. The police understand it, and it puts a target on their back. Every cop in America will tell you that if you ask them.
All right, Mayor Giuliani, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, I've never been much of a Giuliani supporter because of his work on other criminal laws and so forth that impacted a lot of our friends. But anyhow, that's true. And they don't want to admit that the Black Ku Klux Klan is at work. They don't want to admit it. You see, you're dealing with an immature race of people who are not going to catch up no matter what you do. And these liberals, like this guy that was grilling Giuliani, they're the biggest part of the problem because they give him a get out of jail ticket to all these black crazies. And it's you know, going on and on. Son of a bitch. I'd like to see him walk down one of those dark streets and alleys in Chicago and get a good lesson on how not to talk. Again, our biggest problem is among our own race. We don't really have a problem with other races because if our race was acting like it should, there would be none of this nonsense. Well, that's about it for today. Moon's Day. I'll be back tomorrow, 14:05. Hope you enjoyed the video.